in 1989, we met Bill S. Preston and Ted Theodore Logan in the movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. They returned in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey in 1991, and now, almost 30 years later, they're back.
In Bill and Ted Face the Music, Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves return as, well, Bill and Ted, respectively. And this time they'll need not just their triumphant band to save the world, but also their daughters. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Bill and Ted Face the Music on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen from his home studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And also with us from his home in Washington, D.C., we have J.C. Howard, who is a producer of NPR's TED Radio Hour and How I Built This. Hi, J.C.
Hello.
Good to have you back. Good to have you back. So if you are all not familiar, there's not a lot of setup that you need for these films, except to say that Bill and Ted were introduced to us as teenage bro friends who had a band and just wanted to have a triumphant band when they were older. And eventually they got sucked into time travel and picking up different historical figures. And later we're going to try to save the world. And there was a whole story where they were going to ultimately write a great and triumphant song. It is a surprisingly complex canonical story of which you need to know practically nothing in order to enjoy, I think, these films. Stephen, now that I have thoroughly set the table, kind of what is your attachment to Bill and Ted, these movies, if you have one?
Well, I've seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure a bunch of times. I've seen Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey a couple times. Yeah. These are movies that have kind of existed on the wind for the last 30 years. I've rewatched these movies within the last 5 years. I think I talked about them, you know, What's Making Me Happy on this show, but still kind of needed to go back to be reminded of what happens in them going into this movie. I mean, this movie is coasting on goodwill. There is a certain amount of fan service going on here. I mean, I'm not sure how many people were clamoring to revisit these characters almost 30 years later, but at the same time, something really, really smart happens in this movie, and you can tell before you even start watching it, and that is that it is 93 minutes long. All three of these movies are about 90 minutes long, and I think they understand that that is the perfect length here. There is a certain amount of sequel bloat here. The first two movies are incredibly chintzy. The stakes in the first one are no greater than maybe Ted will get sent to military school. And yeah, here there's like the entire fabric of space and time can be ripped apart. This is a very shaggy movie. I think there are stretches where it sags, but I do appreciate the number of updates. You don't have the gay panic stuff that really drags down the earlier movies. There are no gay slurs in this movie. This movie bothers to give its female characters a little bit more agency. The women who become their wives barely have any part to play in the other movies, and here you get more of that. You get their daughters who are given kind of their own subplot. So I appreciate that it's not just rattling around with these two dudes who are now middle-aged, but that they're taking an interest in people outside of just Bill and Ted.
Yeah, and you do get their daughters. It's sort of the structure of this one is kind of that they go on one journey through time, and their daughters, meanwhile, who are played by Samara Weaving and Bridget Lundy Payne, go off and try to get a band together for their dads to play with on this epic song that's supposed to save the world. So you kind of have the one journey going on, the other journey going on, and then naturally in the third act, it all kind of comes together. And I did like those two performances from the daughters. There are also some kind of new faces in this one. Kristen Schaal plays Kelly, who is the daughter of Rufus, who was the George Carlin character in the original. JC, it feels to me like you are too young to have a nostalgic attachment to these movies, but I have been assured that that is not the case because television.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was actually super excited to hear that this movie was happening. And I'm going to show my age a little bit and say that I was born pretty close to the release of the first Bill and Ted movie, of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So my first encounter with these guys was as they say, a most impressionable youth. And yeah, I was one of what I can only assume are millions of kids who watched Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure every time it reran on cable TV. The thing about the first movie is the problem that they needed to solve was very simple. Bill and Ted just needed a good grade.
Right.
Granted, the solution to that problem was a little larger than life and included Doctor Who, like time travel, mm-hmm. phone box and all. But the problem itself was simple. The second movie, Bogus Journey, was certainly a little nuttier. It had killer robots and aliens and the Grim Reaper, but I didn't feel like it hit quite the right notes for me, no pun intended. So when a third film was confirmed, the main question I had was, like, what are they going to do? Are they going to try to recreate the success of the original and go back to simple run-of-the-mill time travel, or lean into the bizarre and crazy? And from just the trailer, it was clear that they weren't going to just lean into the bizarre, but they were diving in headfirst. But I think what separated this one from the 1991 sequel is that it has a lot more heart. The original movie was really about the friendship of Bill and Ted and saving that. They didn't seem to care as much about saving the future as much as they wanted to just make sure that Bill and Ted could still just be friends. So it had this kind of surprisingly earnest quality. And I think that was what was missing in the second film. And this third one, for all of its bizarreness and all of its doubling down on death and heaven and hell and all these kinds of weird things, it really reignites the idea that there are friendships and relationships here that are worth saving.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that they go back to the relationship between those two guys being the center of the story. And I think it's really funny. One of the things that I think is featured in some of the trailer stuff, but they are both married. They both have, you know, lovely wives that you have met before since they got them from the past. And they have relationships with their wives that are completely enmeshed with their relationship with each other. So they can't conceive of having individual marriages that aren't somehow like a four-person marriage. I thought that stuff was sort of funny because I think one of the things that carries over, like if you're going to take these guys and age them 30 years, you have to either assume that at some point they became more normal, which is a weird thing to assume about Bill and Ted, or you have to assume that they are still very Bill and Ted, which would mean that they are still kind of very fixated on this idea that they are a duo and they are always together and they are each other's right hand. Glenn, you had indicated on Twitter that you perhaps did not have the same nostalgia for these characters that perhaps I have and others may have. What is your take here?
All right. The take you're about to hear from me, Linda Holmes, is going to be, it's objective, it's rigorous, it's clear-eyed. It is undimmed by the gauzy scream of nostalgia because, unlike all of y'all, I never saw these movies until this week just to prepare for this show. And I didn't see them for a very simple reason. I didn't have to. I mean, I was a junior in college in 1989. I was studying marine biology. I was dating a string of profoundly unfulfilled women. And you couldn't be on a college campus in 1989 and not hear, whoa, bogus, heinous, strange things are afoot at the Circle K, you know, just over and over and over. So I felt like I got it. And think about the time, late 80s, early 90s, mainstream American comedy was kind of stuck in this catchphrase-based mode. And I was like, okay, I don't need to see this. Well, I've seen them all now, and I'm here to tell you, sure, I guess, if that's your thing. I like the guilelessness of the leads. I think that's the appeal here. But I laughed only once in Excellent Adventure. It's a visual gag that gets tossed off. It's a Freud at a mall holding a corn dog. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, fine, you got me. I mean, it's low-hanging fruit, but you got me. And in Face the Music, this new film, sure, on paper, Samara Weaving, Kristen Schaal, Holland freaking Taylor, they are gunning for me. They are coming. But ultimately, this film didn't stick. It's not supposed to. That's not what it's for. It just evaporates on contact with the eyeballs. And maybe that's exactly what the world needs right now is dumb, sweet, dumb. But I don't get these films.
Yeah, I found it very hard to come up with an answer to the question, like, is this good? Like, it depends on what you're looking for, right? And I think this is sort of how I felt about the Gilmore Girls sequel movies on Netflix. It's how I felt a little bit about the Veronica Mars movie. It is an opportunity to hang out with characters that you haven't had a chance to hang out with in a while. What I really appreciated about the first movie in particular is it has a weirdness to it that I very much appreciate, partly because the dialogue is written with this cadence. You know, you mentioned, Glenn, strange things are afoot at the Circle K. And of course, when you've heard that as a catchphrase for 30 years, it no longer seems weird or funny. The way these guys talk is not just a sort of California surfer kind of thing, but it's like California stoner via Shakespeare or something like that, like via these guys' idea of what it is to sound smart and to be thoughtful. So it's kind of this quasi-profound cadence to the dialogue that brings that movie a real oddness that I appreciated. And I think the only performance in this film that I think really captures that is Bridget Lundy Payne playing Billy, who is Ted's daughter. I do think she does a pretty good job of being 1989 Keanu Reeves in a kind of a slightly updated way. I did appreciate that. And I think in this movie, you know, I felt the pull of nostalgia, obviously. And I just wasn't looking for anything else. You know, Glenn mentioned maybe this is what people want right now. It was originally planned to be a regular theatrical movie. I think it makes a perfect pandemic at home movie. I did find it to be a kind of a balm. I really liked watching these guys work together again. I think the second half of the movie is a lot better than the first half. I think it's shaky at the top. And then by the time it's all kind of coming together in that third act, I did feel like it was a worthwhile sequel to the originals, complete with a lot of, you know, a lot of, like you said, bro friendship without the kind of gay panic elements. JC, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think it's interesting that for me, the thing that I found myself least interested in was the Bill and Ted part of the story. As you mentioned that there are kind of a few stories happening simultaneously. And honestly, I was a lot more interested in the storyline that follows their children. That's something that emerged for me as a kind of interesting theme. There was this like multi-generational element to the film where it turns out the younger generation, whether that's Rufus's daughter or Bill and Ted's kids, they're the ones that have kind of the answers. And honestly, I would have been fine with a movie that kind of used Bill and Ted as an entryway, as a gateway to help us get into the story that mostly followed their kids. Mm-hmm. So if there is a spinoff, a Billy and Thea that follows their kids, I'd give it a try.
I agree with that. I think at the same time, I think the plot line with their daughters is weakened by the fact that I don't think this movie knows as much what to do with the historical figures that it integrates.
Yeah.
Like the first Bill and Ted movie will like turn Napoleon loose in a water park and just like spin jokes out of that. That movie had a little bit more of a sense of like how to derive comedy from historical figures. I think some of the stuff with like the musicians that this movie brings back, it doesn't really know what to do with that comedically. Yeah. And so I think some of those scenes drag a little bit. But at the same time, I think these movies have a 2.5 starriness to them that is very pleasant to revisit.
Now, I am clearly overthinking this, but I always kept trying to figure out the comedy dynamic between Bill and Ted, because it's not traditional. It's not Funny Man and Straight Man. I mean, it's for a lot of straight men. I mean, these films are quintessential straight culture. And not because they call each other a gay slur, because let's face it, it was the late 80s, early 90s. Gay slurs were thick on the ground. It would strain credulity for me if two straight American high school kids didn't call each other that. No, it manifests in little ways in these movies. Like in Bogus Journey, you hire Pam Grier, but you do nothing with her. Mm-hmm. And the other thing in that movie is that Bill and Ted keep referring to themselves as wild stallions when it is clearly established that Joanna and Elizabeth, who will become their wives, are in the band. I mean, Mickey and Davey didn't go around calling themselves the Monkees, so, you know, check your privilege. My problem with these films is essentially that they're Dumb and Dumber, other films I haven't seen. They don't vibe off each other. There's no dynamic where they vibe off each other. It's them that vibes against the world, which is where the comedy comes in.
Yeah.
And the thing that really bugs me is, it kept bumping me out, actually, is these dudes are clearly stoners. They only make sense if they're stoners. But because, I guess, of the PG ratings of those first films, they couldn't be. So every time they walk into, like, one of their personal spaces and the center of the room is not taken up by a huge bong in the shape of an African elephant, I'm like, don't insult my intelligence. Understand who these characters are.
The vibe of Dumb and Dumber is much more kind of gross and vulgar. I think it's exactly what we've already talked about. There's an earnestness to the friendship elements of these films, and it makes total sense to me that that would be not a Glenn thing. But I think the comedy vibe in some ways is that idea that they are so enmeshed with each other and that they see themselves only as a unit moving through the world. So to me, if they have that vibe between the two of them, it's that earnest, loving vibe. And I kind of like it, I got to admit.
I mean, I think it's impossible to watch a movie like this where several actors are reprising roles from like 30 years previous without asking if they can actually find those characters again. Alex Winter pretty much got into Bill S. Preston Esquire, but Keanu's Ted Theodore Logan seemed to have the volume way down.
I felt the same way.
And maybe that's intentional. Maybe it's because the characters are 30 years older and so they've seen their share of disappointment. And maybe it's because Keanu has played in like 50 movies since he was last in this role. Also, to be fair to Keanu, you know, we stand Keanu. He is a cult hero. And I'm sure without the memification of Keanu, this movie wouldn't have happened.
Right.
I do think that his performance as Ted was a little bit turned down.
I agree.
I felt like that was by design. And I feel like there were points in the movie where it kind of even references that, like, Ted isn't quite as in touch with his feelings or in touch with who he is as Bill is. And I appreciated that. And you mentioned that, like, several people are reprising their roles from 30 years ago. I did think it speaks to how poorly developed their wives were in the first two movies, that they recast them here and you don't really even notice.
Yep. And here it's Jemma Mays, who you might know from Glee, and then also Aaron Hayes, who you might know from, I think, mostly television for most people. But at any rate, I think it is safe to say that this film is likely to give you a lot of whatever you thought of the first two films, maybe a little less. I think that is. But it was very welcome for me. I very much enjoyed it as a pandemic break from everything. And you can find it where you're finding your streaming films right now. And we want to hear what you think of it when you get a chance to watch it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Glenlivet's new Caribbean Reserve Expression, a new single malt with a bold tropical twist that is selectively finished in barrels that previously held Caribbean rum, offering a sweet and smooth taste. Learn more at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet Caribbean Reserve Single Malt Scotch Whiskey. Enjoy our quality responsibly. 40% alcohol by volume, 80 proof. 2020 imported by the Glenlivet Distilling Company, New York, New York.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, kick us off. What is making you happy this week?
Abzu, A-B-Z-U, is a very brief little game available pretty much on all platforms. It's very similar to games like Journey and Flower, which we've talked about on the show before. You are an incredibly graceful deep sea diver, and your task is to restore the balance of the blah, 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 blah. Doesn't matter. Who cares? The point is, you swim, and as you go, you restore the polluted industrialized ocean around you to lush, green, vibrant life. And it is frankly amazing to me that an underwater game is so enjoyable, because video games with underwater levels are the bane of my existence. They never get the controls right. This game does, and it's gorgeous to look at and very soothing to play, and gorgeous and soothing are in short supply right now. So that's Abzu, A-B-Z-U.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, every once in a while, one of us on this show spends a week marinating in the problems of the world and finds it incredibly difficult to find something that is making them happy this week. This week, that person is me. I have found the news to be just absolutely crushing this week. And so finding something in pop culture that gives me little shards of joy has been very difficult. And so a little bit earlier this week, I sat down with my daughter and just back-to-back-to-back rewatched the entire Kung Fu Panda trilogy, because that, frankly, my friends, is what I needed this week. I know I've talked about them before. They are a personal favorite of mine. I don't know. It is the exact right level of escape, exactly the right level of plot, but no plot. They're gorgeous to look at. They're funny. They're weirder than you think they're going to be. Sometimes you just got to punt, go back to what you know and love, and just rewatch the Kung Fu Panda trilogy. That was one of the very few things, frankly, that made me happy this week.
You know, when the world feels incredibly insecure and strange and threatening, it is good to know that Stephen Thompson is and always will be a Kung Fu Panda stan. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. JC Howard, what is making you happy this week?
Selena plus Chef.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. It's an HBO Max original show. I've been watching it a lot recently. It's exactly what the title promises. Selena Gomez learning to cook things from fancy chefs who join her virtually in her home kitchen. And the main idea is that while she's stuck at home during the pandemic, she wants to really work on her cooking skills, which especially early in quarantine, a lot of folks did. And as a millennial who in the before times would have at least one or two meals away from home, this show kind of hits different for me. Like in my house, we've started clipping recipes from the New York Times to try. So like that's the level of quarantine where I am. And honestly, it's pretty cool to see Selena Gomez in kind of the same spot. Though, of course, she could probably afford a personal chef, while I could not. But one of the highlights is Selena's knife set, which is this very colorful turquoise-handled titanium-coated knife set that just about every chef comments on them in such a way that I feel like the show should maybe be called Selena plus Chef plus knives. But I've seen a lot of cooking shows, and to someone with less than gourmet culinary skills like myself, I felt like it was super relatable. So I'd say the show is pretty relatable for three kinds of people: your run-of-the-mill foodie, anyone who is developing their cooking skills during quarantine, or anyone who puts on full makeup at home and has a Michelin star chef personally walk them through an original recipe.
Nice.
That's a great recommendation.
Thank you very much, JC Howard. That is a great recommendation. So in a twist, I am also going to talk about something from HBO Max. They have a documentary, which is available as you listen to this, called Class Action Park. And Class Action Park is about the New Jersey theme park that was just called Action Park. Class Action Park is one of its many nicknames, because people got injured a lot. And you will hear people on the internet periodically go through a phase of kind of talking about this place and how crazy it was. It was a water slide park, but the water slides were just designed to be unsafe. It was nutty. Most of the talking heads are like people who worked there, people who were involved in running it. It was mostly run by like 16-year-olds with very little adult supervision, which made it even more unsafe. And parts of the movie are very sad because there were people who were seriously injured and died there. And the film gives a fair kind of shake to that piece of the story. The best thing about it is that one of the talking heads is Chris Gethard. And the comedian Chris Gethard is probably better than anyone at talking about things where sad things and funny things are kind of mushed together. He's actually talked about Action Park before. You can hear it in one of his comedy albums that's entirely about New Jersey, called Taylor Ham, Egg and Cheese. It's a really interesting film that I almost missed. It almost sort of blew right past me. And I'm really, really glad that I encountered it, because it's well worth a watch. I wrote about it on NPR. You can find my review of it there. And I do recommend it. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can find JC at the JC Howard. You can find our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you're bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Be excellent to each other.
Be excellent to each other. Never bogus. We appreciate all of you. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, subscribe to our newsletter. It's over at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week, when we will be talking about the MTV VMAs.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.